You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Obama has been pressuring China to change its trade and currency policies, arguing that China has been keeping its currency artificially low, which puts American businesses at a disadvantage and has led to a significant trade deficit. These kinds of currency wars have become a regular feature of international economics, and James Rickards, a longtime investment banker and risk manager, contends the present situation is a serious threat to the U.S. economy and to national security. His book, Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis, is published by Portfolio Penguin, and he joins us now. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
So how do you define a currency war?
Well, a currency war in its simplest form is simply one country devaluing its currency against the currency of others. And the reason you do this is viewed from outside, you know, people want to buy things in the United States, Boeing aircraft, General Electric, wind turbines, Microsoft software, et cetera. And if our currency gets cheaper, then those foreigners can buy more of that stuff. So it seems to help exports and create jobs.
But is this different from a trade war, for example, tariffs? For example, the United States keeps certain prices artificially high to prevent competition from other countries.
Well, it's you can call it manipulation or you can call it policy. Sure, every country cares about their interest rates, their exchange rate, their fiscal policy. So it is another instrument of policy. The problem is it doesn't operate in a vacuum. It invites retaliation, and that's when you tiptoe up to the trade wars.
Well, I said that you consider the present situation a serious threat to the U.S. economy, mm-hmm. but should I have said the global economy?
Yes, because trade wars tend to go global because of retaliation. We're seeing it already. As the U.S. dollar, as the U.S. Has tried to make the dollar cheaper, it's actually created inflation overseas. A lot of critics of the Fed said, boy, you printed $2 trillion. The Fed printed $2 trillion between 2008 and 2011, and they were worried about inflation. But in fact, inflation has not shown up in the United States, and Paul Krugman and Ben Bernanke and others have said that. But the inflation did show up in China and around the world, in North Africa and South America. So we were exporting our inflation because other countries were trying to maintain the peg.
Well, there's been a lot of attention put on China in recent years. It's been accused of keeping the value of its currency, the yuan, artificially low. Why is this a problem not just for the United States, for all of the countries around the world? You say that to some degree we are causing them problems as well.
Correct.
China.
No doubt that China manipulates their currency, but there's no bigger manipulator of currency in the world than the United States. The Chinese hope to have a peg between their currency, the yuan, and the U.S. dollar, which kind of goes back to the old Bretton Woods system of the 1950s and the 1960s when currencies were pegged. That gives you, as an investor or an entrepreneur, gives you some certainty. They relied on that, but the United States decided to break the peg. And the way to understand—
When did we do that?
Beginning in 2009 with quantitative easing and then later quantitative easing part two, so-called QE2, Operation Twist. The interest rates were already at zero at the short end. The Fed couldn't lower them anymore, but they could devalue the dollar, which is what they were trying to do. So by printing money, the money went to China to buy their goods and also hot money, chasing investment opportunities. The Chinese, to maintain the peg, they had to print their own currency to soak up the dollar. So the inflation showed up in China. Now, the Fed has won round one. The Chinese finally decide to revalue the currency upward to fight inflation, which is a threat inside China. But all that means is that the inflation is now going to come back to the United States in the form of higher prices for imported goods. So we're going to get that inflation at the end of the day.
Because we rely on China to keep our prices down.
Correct. But that advantage is starting to go away because we've devalued the dollar.
But haven't we gone through similar cycles over the years? Japan used to be the supplier of cheap goods. Now it's China. But we also have gone to Korea. We've gone to Vietnam, to Thailand. So does it really matter? Isn't there always – we can go to Guatemala at some point and all throughout Central America and get – goods at the same kind of cheap prices we were getting them from China.
Well, you make a very good point, Leonard, which is we fought the currency wars in the 1970s, and at the time, Germany and Japan were the export powerhouses. Well, guess what? They're still export powerhouses. The dollar, when I started in banking in the 70s, it was 350 yen to the dollar. Today, it's only 70 yen to the dollar. So the dollar has gone down about 75% against the yen. But Japan is still an export powerhouse. It just proves that cheapening your currency doesn't work. But it causes other problems.
You took part in a simulated financial war game at the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Now, why the Pentagon and why not the Council of Economic Advisors?
Well, it's a really good question. What it shows is the merger of national security threats and economic threats. And Secretary Clinton, in a series of recent speeches, has said, we're not going to conduct any U.S. foreign policy without taking into account economic policy. She said, we need to get out of the war room and into the boardroom, showing the combination of the two. The Pentagon recognized that you can't have strong national security without a strong dollar. I mean, how are we going to pay for all this? How are we going to project power, et cetera? And they've conducted many war games over the years on simulations, and they said, let's have a financial war game. So that's how it got started.
And who was involved?
The Pentagon, the intelligence community, the State Department, the Treasury, there were a number of Department of Energy, Department of Commerce. There were a number of government agencies involved. My role was that they knew how to do war games, but they didn't understand Wall Street. So I was brought in as a Wall Street expert. People on Wall Street fight games, you know, have games all the time, you know, manipulation, front running, you know, et cetera. And so use those tactics.
There are an awful lot of people who were sleeping in Zuccotti Park who were angry about all of that stuff.
Well, they should be angry. There should be a lot more people on Wall Street in jail, in my opinion. I've been on Wall Street a long time. A lot of good people in the industry, but some not so good people also. But the point is, knowing those kinds of techniques, and to be clear, I'm a lawyer and a compliance officer, so I try to make sure people don't do those things. But I do understand how those games are played. We took that into the war room atmosphere, and what we said was, you cannot fight with missiles or tanks or guns. You can only fight with stocks, bonds, derivatives, and currencies. And how could nations damage each other, gain power, and injure their rivals using financial markets?
Do you think that we're on the brink or even in the midst of a currency war now?
Oh, there's no question about it. You look at the Chinese yuan has gone up over 10% against the dollar in the past year. Now, think about the fact that Chinese own $3 trillion of U.S. dollar-denominated securities. If you devalue the dollar 10%, that's a $300 billion wealth transfer from China to the United States. At the same time, China is stealing intellectual property from the United States, whether it's books, movies, TV, or more serious things like blueprints for secret aircraft. And they're probably stealing $300 billion a year from us in intellectual property. So maybe we're even, but this war is well underway.
Is this whole thing being exacerbated by the problems in the Eurozone?
Absolutely. And it's a very interesting thing. I've been one of the folks saying that the euro is strong and getting stronger, which it has been. And everyone's saying, you know, wailing, oh, the euro is going to collapse, et cetera. There are two problems there. People don't understand the differences between the bonds, the banks, and the currency. The euro sovereign bonds are a mess. They're only worth 40 cents on the dollar in some cases. The banks are a mess. Some of them are going to fail and be nationalized. That does not mean the currency is a mess. The currency union will remain strong because the European currency union has always been more of a political project than an economic project. Of course, it has economic aspects, but it's really it's turning out to be what I call the Fourth Reich, Germany's way of asserting economic hegemony over Europe without firing a shot. People get upset when I say that because they think about the Third Reich, but I think about the First Reich of Charlemagne and really how they exerted hegemony over Europe.
But does Germany have any other option? It is the strongest economy in Europe. I mean, aren't they just defending their own interests?
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons I've said the euro will not fall apart, because at the end of the day, Germany will help make it stick together. So I agree with that completely. You're right.
China has been supporting the euro, and the United States has as well. Do we have much of a choice?
No, because Europe is the U.S.'s largest trading partner, and actually Europe is China's largest trading partner. China does more trade with Europe than with the United States. And so this is how the currency wars are fought. Not everybody can devalue against everybody. Somebody has to have the strong currency. Turns out to be Europe.
But then Europe went to China recently and said, help us out more, and China said no.
Well, China said sort of a conditional no. They're going to say yes, but subject to certain conditions. They want access to infrastructure, access to critical technology. They want to buy ports, highways, and they want hardware and software and militarily sensitive technology that they have been denied. When they get that stuff, they'll buy the bonds.
My guest is James Rickards. His book is called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. What are the triggers of a currency war?
It's a very good question. It really starts with excessive debt. And in addition to my economics chapters, I also have several historical chapters. And the period today looks a lot like 1919. After World War I, Germany owed large reparations to England and France, but England and France owed war debts to the United States. Everybody was indebted to everyone else. It couldn't be paid. So you become desperate for growth. Now, you look at the components of growth. It's consumption. Well, right now, consumption is kind of flat because of, you know, student loans and mortgages and credit cards. Investment is flat because why are you going to build new plant equipment if there's no one there to buy your stuff? Government spending hit the wall with the Tea Party and the debt ceiling debate we saw in August. So when you take those three things out, what's left of growth? Well, the only thing left is net exports, and the fastest way to get your net exports going is to cheapen your currency. So currency wars begin when there's not enough growth, and growth comes from too much debt. That's where we are.
But to create more exports, we have to hire people. We're not hiring people.
Well, that's right. That's because we're more efficient. The other problem is that, sure, a cheaper currency might help your exports. But remember, we import a lot of stuff. So a cheaper currency makes that more expensive. So for every winner in a currency war, there's a hidden loser you don't hear as much about. We're probably killing as many jobs as we're creating.
A listener, Mike from Rockland County, asks, can you further explain how the U.S. exports inflation to other countries?
Sure. It comes through the exchange rate mechanism. If you fix the dollar and the Chinese yuan at a fixed level, and the Fed prints money, and that money goes to China. Now, what happens when it gets to China? If you're an exporter, you export stuff to the United States, you get dollars. The People's Bank of China says, give us the dollars. We'll give you local currency to meet your payroll. Well, that means they have to print their currency to soak up the dollars. So the inflation actually shows up there because they're printing so much local currency. So it goes through the exchange rate mechanism.
Do currency wars, are they always the result of periods of domestic crisis? Distress?
They're the result of lack of growth domestically. Yes, you could say distress, and the U.S. is in one right now. We're in my view, this is not a recession or a double-dip recession. We're actually in a depression that started in 2007, will run at least till 2014, depending on policy, in my view. So, yes, that is the catalyst for currency wars.
Are you the only one who's calling it a depression? There is a fear of calling anything a depression, isn't there?
Well, there is, but it's
– And wasn't the recession declared over at one point?
Well, technically it was, but the best description of depression economics I've ever heard comes from a Paul Simon song called Allergies. He said, we get better, but we never get well. And the point is, you can have growth in a depression, but you never get well. You never get out of it until some policy changes. That's where we're in today.
Well, when I look at some of the things that led to the changes in the past, the end of World War I, we wound up with serious currency wars. You mm-hmm. referred to them earlier.
Right.
And that all ended when Hitler came to power.
Correct.
In fact, our depression ended with World War II.
Correct.
It always seems to be something terrible that finally kicks us into a better situation.
Well, that was the case in what I call Currency War I, which is sort of coterminous with the Great Depression. There was also Currency War II, which took place in the 60s and 70s. That came in for more of a negotiated settlement rather than a shooting war with Secretary Baker and the Louvre Accord in 1987. But it was one of the worst periods of growth in American history. We had three recessions back to back to back in 1974, 1979, and 1980. The dollar collapsed. Gold went to went up 20 times from $35 an ounce to $800 an ounce, more than 20 times. We had hyperinflation. The value of the dollar was cut in half between 1977 and 1981. So that was it didn't end up in a shooting war, but it was disastrous economically.
My guess is James Rickards. He has some controversial ideas about the gold standard, which we will discuss in just a few moments after we take a little break. His book is called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. Stay with us. We're back with James Rickards. His book, Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis, published by Portfolio Penguin. The gold standard features largely in your discussion of currency wars. Can you explain how the gold standard worked? Is it in effect at all these days in our country?
Well, it's not in effect at all today, but it has worked in the past. The problem, Leonard, is there's no one gold standard. There are different kinds of gold standards, and it's kind of hard to have an adult conversation about gold. As soon as you mention the G word, people marginalize you and say, oh, you're a wingnut or whatever. And I thought that was odd. I studied the history of it, and from 1870 to 1914, we had a very successful gold standard. So I sort of probed on that a little bit.
Well, not everybody thought it was successful. successful. We had a presidential campaign claiming that we were being crucified on a cross of gold.
Well, that's right. But that candidate, William Jennings Bryan, lost to William McKinley, and the gold standard was upheld. And it was a great period of prosperity and deflation. We actually had declining prices and growth. That's a very nice combination when you can get it. But the problem with gold today was really something called the gold exchange standard of the 1920s. What happened there is the gold standard was suspended in World War I. The countries wanted to go back to it in the 1920s. But Winston Churchill insisted on the pre-World War I price. The problem is they had doubled the paper money supply in the meantime, which means if you want that price, you have to cut the money supply in half. So it did contribute to the Depression.
I want to get back to a statement you made that after McKinley, and then we went to Teddy Roosevelt, we had both deflation and we had – but weren't the low prices fueled by the fact that we had cheap immigrant labor? Well, right now, I'm not suggesting that we have cheap immigrant labor again, but right now the move is in a very different direction.
Well, we have some cheap immigrant labor because
not in Alabama. No.
Well, not in certain states, but we also have technology. We get productivity. The really declining prices come from productivity. Productivity has two components. One is labor. The other is technology. Neither one can be a contributor. We actually have a natural the thing is there's good deflation and bad deflation. Bad deflation comes when the unemployment is high, debts cannot be paid, et cetera. Good deflation comes through innovation and technology. Our computers have gone from $4,000 to $400 in a matter of a few years, and that's a good kind of deflation.
Now, you're suggesting a return to the gold standard
Yes.
in some form? Well, gold right now is very, very expensive. Would returning to the gold standard bring the price down to something more reasonable?
No, returning to the gold standard will take the price to somewhere around $7,000 an ounce. And the reason is the problem of the 1920s, you've got to get the price right. When you structure a gold standard, you ask yourself a couple things. Every gold standard is a relationship between paper money and gold. So what's our definition of paper money? You've got M0, M1, they're all different. How much gold backing do you need? 20%, 40%, 100%? And who's in the club? Is it everybody or just the U.S.?
Well, when I was a kid, I was told that I could cash in a dollar and then I could get the equivalent from Fort Knox in gold.
Well, you could. My father used...
Nobody ever did that.
Well, but the pack in large size, you couldn't do it for a $20 bill, but you could do it in large size. And that was true up until 1933.
Oh, well, that's before I was a kid.
Okay. But the point is, you know, it was 1933 that President Roosevelt confiscated the gold of the American citizens and devalued the dollar against gold. And then in 1971, we went off the international gold standard. It plays no role today, but the reason the price would be so high, it's really – these are not pie-in-the-sky projections. It's just the relationship between paper and gold.
And what led us to get off of the international gold standard in 1971? That was during the Nixon administration?
Correct. It was really the guns and butter policy of Lyndon Johnson that was continued into the Nixon administration. We were fighting a war in Vietnam and launching the Great Society at the same time. We were running budget deficits and trade deficits, not unlike today. And there was an attack on the dollar. In those days, if you had dollars, if you were France or the Netherlands or Italy, you could take your dollars and cash them in for gold. And that's what people were doing. Charles de Gaulle sent the French Navy to New York to pick up his share of the gold. And finally, Nixon said, no more, we're going to cut it out.
So you're suggesting a flexible gold standard. How would that work?
The way it would work is you would basically do these variables I described, and then you would set a tentative target price, and say $5,000 an ounce would be a good place to start. And the Fed would be a market maker. They'd be a buyer at $49.95 and a seller at $5,050 to maintain the price. Well, if everyone showed up dumping gold at the Fed's doorstep, you would know the price was too high. Conversely, if everyone showed up with dollars and said, give me the gold, you would know it was too low. You'd actually use the market to figure out the right price. I don't know the right price, but I think I know the right questions.
Do you think Ron Paul would like this proposal?
I think actually Ron Paul's views are a little more libertarian than what I just described. He would say, get rid of the Fed and let people walk around with gold coins.
Well, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke points out that the countries that were on the gold standard during the Great Depression were among the last to recover.
Well, Chairman Bernanke is correct about that, but the reason is that when you went off the gold standard, you devalued. So it's like saying, if I stole your wallet, I'd be better off. Is that our model?
But right now we're concerned about recovery, aren't we?
Well, the whole world's concerned about recovery. I'd like to see recovery through growth, through innovation, technology, entrepreneurship. Let's get rid of the corporate income tax. Let's get rid of capital gains taxes.
The Federal Reserve wasn't created until 1913. What brought about its creation?
It was really the result of the panic of 1907. In 1907, the banking system almost collapsed. J.P. Morgan, the man, not the institution, organized a private rescue over at his townhouse in Maryhill. But the bankers, it was such a close call, they said, you know what, JP won't be around forever, and we need the government to be able to bail out the banks. So the Fed was really created to produce unlimited money to bail out banks, and it's been bailing out banks ever since.
You point out that among the bankers who met to create the Fed were Frank Vanderlip of National City Bank and Charles Norton of the First National Bank, which later merged to become Citibank. Which in 2008 received the biggest bailout in history.
Right.
So has the Fed come full circle here?
Well, sure. It took 80 years, but they got the bailout they were looking for in 1913. Absolutely. It worked the way it was supposed to. The Fed, anything they do for the economy is incidental. Their main job is to help the banks.
My guest is James Rickards, whose book is called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've been circling around history, but let's get specific again. Some of the more significant modern currency wars the United States has been tangled up in. How did the Treaty of Versailles, which was at the end of World War I, trigger a currency war?
The Treaty of Versailles imposed unpayable reparations on Germany. Now, the United States and President Wilson actually knew that that was a bad idea, but there was just too much anger and bitterness in England and France. They wanted kind of financial revenge. So they put these reparations on Germany. Germany couldn't pay them. So they had the Weimar Republic hyperinflation of the early 1920s to try to get out from under that burden.
They just kept on printing money?
They printed money. France actually invaded Germany to take payment in kind. They literally ripped up railroads, moved factories, dug up coal, etc. The German workers, to resist, they couldn't resist militarily. They went on strike, and the German government printed money to pay the workers, and then their currency collapsed. Interestingly, Germany came back a year later and went on the gold standard, and between 1924 and 1929, they had the fastest growing major economy in the world because they went back to gold.
Now, was the Great Depression in any way related to this?
It was absolutely related because you had, as I said, you can't not everyone can devalue against everyone at the same time, but you can take turns, and that's what happened. In 1925, France devalued. In 1931, England. 1933, the United States. 1936, France again. So the problem with the gold standard in the 1920s, they got the price wrong. It wasn't gold. It was the price. That $20 price was wrong. If you had gone to gold in 1925 at, say, $50 an ounce, that would have been mildly inflationary. You might have avoided the Great Depression completely. But by picking a deflationary price, it contributed to the Great Depression.
Do you see any parallels to the situation today, what's happening with Greece's sovereign debt crisis and the threat to Italy as well?
I do, Leonard. When there's too much debt, and that's exactly what we have today, there are only three ways out. One is deflation, and we're seeing that in Greece today. I'm sorry, one is default. Default is what we're seeing in Greece today. The second is inflation, which is the policy of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. Just, I'll pay you back, but the money's not worth very much. The third way out, the one I prefer, is growth. Let's grow our way out so we can actually pay our debts in real terms. But the policy for growth is what Volcker and Reagan did. It was hard money and low taxes. Today we have easy money and high taxes, so it's exactly the wrong medicine.
You say we have high taxes? There's a big war over who's paying those taxes. Are you just talking about high taxes for everyone, or do you think that there should be higher taxes on that 1% that the Occupy people are protesting against?
Look, I think there should be lower statutory tax rates to get more tax collections. I understand the
– in Greece, they don't collect taxes at all, according to every report I've heard.
Well, that's the point. We don't collect them in this country because of deductions, loopholes, and tax planning. So you may have a statutory rate of 39%, but people find ways around that. If you put it at, say, 25%, they'd actually hand it over. And our corporate tax is way too high.
We mentioned what happened when President Nixon announced his new economic policy, which included going off the gold standard in 1971. And following that, the country suffered from recession, stagflation, oil prices went up, and the price of gold skyrocketed. But hadn't we gone through similar things when we had the gold standard in place?
There were sure. There were always panics and crashes. So even in the heyday of the classical gold standard between 1870 and 1914, there was the panic of 1893 and the panic of 1898. Those things happened for other reasons. There's a difference between a financial panic and a depression. Sometimes they come together. Sometimes they come separately. You're always going to have a business cycle. You're always going to have panics. But the question is, do you have sound money?
Now, what's your assessment of how the Fed has acted recently, its efforts to help stabilize the economy through quantitative easing and lowering interest rates? Has that worked?
It's really reckless. And my analogy there, Leonard, is you have a thermostat in your house. If it's too cold, you dial it up a little bit, make it a little hotter, and vice versa. And the Fed thinks they have a thermostat to dial up the money supply. But the problem is it's more like a nuclear reactor where you have fuel rods and control rods. You can dial it up, but if you get it wrong, it'll be a catastrophic meltdown. So they think they're playing with a thermostat, but they're playing with a nuclear reactor.
A listener asks, can you explain in more precise detail how short-term foreign currency fluctuations, 1 to 3 month periods, for example, are corrected for by exporters through immediate changes in the prices of traded goods?
Well, there is something called the J-curve, which means that when you revalue a currency, the export effect takes place with a lag. So short-term swings in a matter of months aren't going to change very much. I would say the exchange rates don't change export flows at all. Take the iPhone, for example. We all love our iPhones. They come from China, but only 6% of the value added of an iPhone is Chinese. The rest of the value added comes from South Korea, Japan, Germany. They make the touchscreens and the processors. So a 50% devaluation against the yuan only changes the price of an iPhone by 3%.
But these are American products.
It's American technology, sure.
So how much of that pie does Apple get?
Apple gets a lot of it. That's the point.
Simply for developing it, inventing it.
Correct.
But haven't people suggested that that's the way of the future for America? We will come up with the ideas and have other people manufacture?
Well, what's wrong with 65,000 manufacturing jobs in the United States? I agree that American technology is the best in the world, or universities are the best in the world. That's our edge.
But we're seeing a change a bit there as well. China seems to be developing pretty sophisticated technological approaches.
They are, and they're doing a lot in scientific research and a lot in the military front. So, you know, it's not surprising they're making headway. But the problem is really jobs in both countries, China and the U.S.
You write of the four horsemen of the dollar apocalypse, four possible outcomes for the dollar in the current currency war. Can you describe them?
You're from most benign to most dangerous. The first one is a world of multiple reserve currencies. Between 2000 and today, the dollar share of U.S. reserves has dropped from 70% to 60%. Imagine it going down to 40%, Europe coming up to 40%. You have I call this kumbaya approach. The problem is there's no anchor. Without gold, instead of one central bank behaving badly, they might all behave badly. So it could be a race to the bottom. The second one, the one favored by the global elites, what I call the Davos crowd, is SDR. It sounds geeky, but it's a special drawing right. The way to understand that, the Fed has a printing press. We can print dollars. Well, it's a surprise to most people that the IMF has a printing press, and they can print these SDRs.
So would the IMF be operating as a global central bank?
De facto, it has already become a global central bank. The next time there's an acute phase of the financial crisis, something like the Lehman moment in 2008, it'll be too big for the Fed, and the bailout will come not from the Fed but from the IMF by printing SDRs. So that's definitely on the horizon. My third horseman of the apocalypse is a gold standard, which we've already talked about. And the fourth, the one I think the most likely, is chaos. And I say that it's not what anybody wants, but through denial and wishful thinking and delay, we may just fall into it.
Well, that's what happened in 1929, isn't
Correct.
It? So this is what happens if investor confidence collapses totally. Are we on the verge of seeing something like that?
That potential is there, and in the book I give actually a model. And when you understand it as a critical dynamic system, it's a little bit technical. But the point is that minute changes can cause catastrophic differences in the outcome. My metaphor there is a snowflake and an avalanche. A certain snowflake hits the mountain. Next thing you know, you have an avalanche. Do you blame the snowflake, or was it the instability of the mountainside? I say it's the instability of the mountainside, and that instability is built into our financial system, so it's a very dangerous state of affairs.
Well, we are near the end of this discussion. Can you leave us with any shred of optimism about the current economic situation?
Sure. We've been here before, I think is the best way to put it. And we got out of it. But we got out of it in 1981 after gold went from $35 to $800, as we mentioned. The price of gold never really changes. What happens is the dollar was collapsing. But Paul Volcker and Ronald Reagan gave us hard money and low taxes. And that's the way out. Make the U.S. a magnet for investment from around the world.
Well, the debate is often framed as Keynes versus Hayek, or I've been hearing more and more Ayn Rand, although I'm not sure how that works. Does either of them offer a better solution to the current situation?
I think they both do. I'm actually a fan of John Maynard Keynes. My problem is with Keynesianism. Keynesianism, as it's evolved since 1947, has very little to do with John Maynard Keynes. It's become a kind of new science unto itself. But Keynes pointed out that we do need liquidity from time to time. And Hayek said, let's trust the free markets. Nobody's smart enough to dictate outcomes. So you combine those things, you can get some pretty good results.
A listener asks, isn't preventing another Lehman-style meltdown also important here? Do you think that having banks that are too big to fail is a bad idea?
It's a terrible idea, and I have bad news for the listener, which is the banks that were too big to fail are today bigger. The five largest banks have a larger market share, larger off-balance sheet liabilities than they did in 2008. So they said Dodd-Frank would get rid of bailouts, but it actually institutionalized bailouts.
Another listener asks, if a drop in the American standard of living to a more sustainable and competitive level I don't know how this sentence doesn't mean anything. What's required for us to get to that point?
Well, you need
do we want a drop in the American standard of living?
Absolutely not. What we want is growth, but the question is how to get there. And as I've outlined, I think stable money – knowing what the value of your money is worth and strong money and low taxes is a great combination.
James Rickard's book is called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.